Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're ready to hear oral argument in the case of Krislov against Yarbrough. Mr. Krislov.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's good to see you three. This case is brought on behalf of Mike Powers, who was a signature supporter of my campaign and myself. My petitions for the ballot for the Illinois Supreme Court were rejected based on signatures. And the issue is whether the state, where the state erects numeric hurdles to ballot access, if it, it must permit statistical evidence to show that that hurdle has been met, and it's refusing to permit candidates to show that the statistical margins of error show that the hurdle has been met is a violation of First Amendment and, I guess, due process in Judge Kendall's view. She viewed it as being, there are two counts of the complaint. One was under 1983, one was the pendant state statutory count. But the fact of the matter is, it what we address is under 1983 primarily, the system's rejection of...
Mr. Krislov, before we get too deep into the merits, I think we need to address the question whether we have an ongoing controversy within the scope of Article 3.
We do, Your Honor. Because, number one, for my own candidacy of the future, and frankly, in every election cycle, whether it's Illinois or nationwide, the issue of ballot petition signatures arises. And there's always somebody who comes up who is found to be short, a handful.
Mr. Krislov, I understand that there's always someone who is bound to be very close to the signature limit. But under the Supreme Court's cases, for example, Weinstein against Bradford, the case remains justiciable only if that someone is you, particularly. And I wonder what reason we would have to believe that you will run again and be so close to the number of signatures that counting errors would be dispositive.
In all likelihood, the way that these battles play out is that the opponent, if it be an organization candidate or somebody with a ton of money, then challenges all of the signatures. And everybody, including me, will be in the position that you are in an arduous battle for the numbers and defending the signatures in a system which has only lay people who are not experts in this field, who are not educated in signature recognition. And it is like, and there will be signature battles in every contest that I've been
Mr. Krislov, let me repeat. Yes. Under Weinstein against Bradford, the fact that this kind of controversy may arise with respect to someone in the state of Illinois is not sufficient. It must arise with respect to you in particular. And so I'm asking what reason we have to believe that potential errors in verifying signatures will mark the difference for you in particular between satisfying and not satisfying the 0.4% threshold.
For me, it is that in every election that I've been in to this point and will be in for the future, that issue of the ballot of the number of signatures will be a hotly contested battle. I cannot tell you that it will be how narrow it will be, but the fact is, under the public interest exception,
Mr. Krislov, your brief talks about a public interest exception, but I'm not aware of any such thing. Could you tell me what decision of the Supreme Court establishes this and why you think Weinstein against Bradford has been overruled?
Weinstein hasn't been overruled, but it is capable of repetition, and this scenario will play out, and it will play out in any future election that I'm in.
But I share the same bafflement that my colleague does. There's going to be a number of signatures in any election under this Illinois law. It happened to be 5,050 this time. It'll be some other number another time. Let's say, hypothetically, it'd be 5,100 signatures. But you will, one would imagine, play it safe, you know, and instead of having double the number of signatures you need, roughly, maybe you'll have triple. I mean, I don't know what enables us to say that you won't have the right number of signatures again. This isn't like deciding whether people who are in-state residents or out-of-state people can collect them. And if there's a remedy, well, if there's any likelihood that this simply won't come up, you're asking us to render an advisory opinion.
It's going to come up, and it is capable of repetition without protection.
Why does it not apply to every other person who ran with signatures in Illinois? Some people made the cut, and other people didn't.
But the people who didn't make the cut, of them, I was the one who postured the statistical margins of error that showed that even for the most rigorous forensic document examiners, both the number of erroneous deductions and increases would have put me well over the top. I had twice as many signatures. The process is what we're challenging.
Let me just interrupt and say a giant problem for me. This is merits. This assumes we get over mootness, but we'll probably return to that. But I know of nothing in the federal constitution that says to a state, you have to say it's 5,050 signatures plus or minus, you know, 100. If a state wants to have a specific number, that's what the states have usually done. And maybe you have a better system. Maybe you could persuade Illinois to enact a better system, but I don't know where in the constitution that tells Illinois it has to do this.
It doesn't, the Constitution doesn't establish a percentage one way or the other, but the system, which is fundamentally flawed, must afford a candidate the opportunity, when requested, to show that by statistical evidence,
Why? We
have the right number. Because to not do that is to erect a hurdle that makes it impossible for non-organization candidates who don't have millions of dollars to run. And that is
fundamental. Mr. Krisloff, how does it make it impossible? Suppose Illinois were to require not 0.4%, but 1%. Would that violate the Constitution?
If it had a specific amount that could be shown to be statistically invalid or valid.
No, Mr. Krisloff, I wish you'd address my question.
I'm trying to.
The statute said 1% rather than 0.4%. Would it be invalid?
Of the number of the people, of the past voters that you have to reach?
Exactly the same statute, which right now says 0.4% of the total votes cast in the district for the candidate for governor from the political party, et cetera, from your party. But if it's, so Judge Easterbrook's question, suppose it said 1%, that would be more signatures you'd need to get, of course. Anything wrong with that?
Not necessarily, but still at that level, you'd still have to be able to show by statistical evidence that you had met it.
Why? And that you, why isn't the state entitled, as the state courts have said, to say, we're using real numbers here. We don't want to hear about this. And so any statistical adjustment has to be above the floor.
The statistical adjustment, if we had professional forensic document examiners doing this, you would say, well, the numbers are then reliable, or they're reliable at least to the plus 5.3% and minus 1.6%.
Do you know state in the country that has said only professionally certified signature comparers can do this? Is that what Georgia did in the most recent?
Not asking for the requirement to be specific forensic.
So in other words,
examiner.
No, we don't know of anybody who says that.
No, and I'm not asking for that. What I'm saying is that a state that establishes a system where lay people make the count without affording the candidates and their supporters the opportunity, when requested, to show by statistical evidence that we have reached the numbers. You have erected a hurdle, an unconstitutional hurdle to ballot access. And that's what Chris Love...
As Judge Wood predicted, I want to return for a moment to mootness. Even if you could somehow show capable of repetition, how can this case evade review in light of the fact that you could have gone to the state court to challenge the board's decision, but never did that?
That's certainly futile.
Something that would be available to you in the future.
It will be futile. I mean, we'll go through this again and again and again, and it will be futile when you go through the state system.
But on what basis would it be futile? Can we make that determination as we sit here today?
By the time that any of this would be resolved in that next election, the election would, as it was here, would be over. I mean, by just the fact of the timing of the court below, it was well after the election had occurred.
But you didn't bring a challenge. We don't know what the timing would be. You didn't bring a challenge here before the state court.
If the state court, number one, would be futile, would be asserted. And number two, even just by the timing of the court below, it would tell you that by the time that would be resolved on that issue, the election would be over and the time would be gone. And so it will repeat itself again and again and again in every cycle I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal if I could.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Krislov. Mr. Henready.
Thank you, Honor. May it please the court. Assistant State's Attorney Lyle Henready, on behalf of the Cook County Officers Electoral Board, its members, and their designees. The appellants seek federal court intervention to review how the Electoral Board implements state law, namely the requirement that a candidate must obtain the threshold numbers of signatures in order to appear on the ballot. The appellants have conceded that they're not challenging the statute itself, but just the procedures used by the Electoral Board to ensure compliance. And I think appellants have failed to state their claim for five reasons. First and foremost, the district court properly denied the appellants leave to file an amended complaint because by the time they sought leave to do so, their claims were moot. Second, the federal district courts have no supervisory authority to instruct the Electoral Board on how to follow state law, and the Illinois Supreme Court has already weighed in on this issue exactly in the Jackson Hicks case. Third, in Jeunesse, the United States Supreme Court upheld a signature requirement accounting for more than 5% of the entire eligible voting population in Georgia. As Judges Wood and Easterbrook mentioned, the Illinois requirement is only for 0.4% of the total votes cast by the candidate's political party in the most recent gubernatorial election. And that burden is a great deal lower than the one deemed constitutionally adequate in Jeunesse. Fourth, the appellant's claims are barred by the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. And fifth, the appellant's failure to serve all necessary parties would require the dismissal of the state claim. As this court stated in Casper v. Board of Election Commissioners, the federal district court has no supervisory power and no authority to instruct an election board on how to follow state law. It's in fact called such claims feeble. And even a deliberate violation of state election law is not enough to state a claim under Section 1983, as such a violation does not transgress the Constitution.
So Mr. Henready, let me just ask you a hypothetical question. It's not here to my knowledge, but are you saying that there's really no possible federal claim with the way these signatures are counted? So that if somebody just said, well, I write down, that every third signature is invalid, or I write down that two out of three of the signatures are invalid for everybody, I just follow that practice without even looking at them.
Sure. To answer your question, Judge, I think there's sort of two potential avenues. The first avenue is there is a due process right, which Mr. Krislov could have gone up through the Illinois State Court on. There's very specific rules under the Illinois Election Code, and they are actually quite tight in time frame because they do contemplate the fact that elections are time sensitive. The other issue would be whether or not there could ever be a federal due process violation based on the actions of an electoral board. And the answer to that is yes, there are circumstances, but those are usually related to when the board deviates from their own rules without properly announcing it in a way that the candidates wouldn't be able to anticipate. I'm specifically thinking of the case of Briscoe v. Cusper, which I don't think we cited, so it's at 435 F2nd 1046. So under those circumstances, I think there could be a due process claim, but if it's simply the matter of the board itself not following either its own rules or the state rules, the proper venue for that would be the state court.
So I take it from your description that the Illinois Election Code actually establishes a fairly expedited procedure for the state court review. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's in the first instance, it's 5 days, and it's not in the record. But I mean, this happens all the time. They're prepared for it, and they do it quite quickly. Mm-hmm. So the appellants have argued that they have a viable cause of action, in their words, either whether they phrase it as a due process or a First Amendment complaint, but they failed to plead either specifically in this case. As to the First Amendment claim, it's undisputed that ballot access implicates the First Amendment. However, not all restrictions on candidate eligibility for the ballot impose constitutionally suspect burdens. And here, a state election regulation passes constitutional muster it's non-discriminatory and reasonably related to the state's important interest in protecting the integrity and reliability of the election process. And it's undisputed that the states have the right to make candidates to make a preliminary showing of substantial support in order to qualify for a place on the ballot, as we already discussed.
And I know you've relied on Jackson Hicks for there is no close enough that you really have to show 5,050 in this particular case. Valid signatures.
Correct, Your Honor. And there's no, you know, Mr. Krizloff talked about statistical analysis. I don't believe there is statistical analysis in this case. I think it's simply counting. They either make it to the threshold or they don't. Also, through the state law, if a candidate wishes to go back to the electoral board and say, we think that these signatures were in fact valid, they can present affidavits. Mr. Krizloff did in this case present affidavits, and I think the number went from 118 to 108, so it just didn't make it. And then as to the procedural due process claim, it was, as pled, identical to the First Amendment claim other than changing the title. And regardless of that, the appellants cannot state a viable federal due process claim, as an adequate remedy was available to them, as we just discussed, through the Illinois Supreme Court system. The Illinois court system, up to the Illinois Supreme Court. And Mr. Krizloff mentioned that would be futile, but hasn't provided any reason as to the futility. Futility doesn't hinge on whether or not the applicant achieved their desired outcome. And as this court's noted, the failure of an appellant challenge doesn't make it futile, because in fact, most appeals fail in the Health Equity Urbana Inc. case v. Sullivan.
Well, I think his suggestion was that it would be futile because he wouldn't get a ruling in time.
Yeah, and as I stated, I know under the Illinois court system, this is done every election cycle. And I don't think that getting an opinion in time would be a problem, and it isn't generally. And as the court previously discussed, or as we previously discussed, the appellants made no effort to amend their complaint until after the March 17th, 2020 election. And by that point, their case was moot, and there is no longer a live case or controversy, because Mr. Krizloff can't be retroactively placed on the ballot. And also because, as to Mr. Krizloff, this is not a capable of repetition yet evading review case, because Mr. Krizloff would have to run again. He would have to collect sufficient number of signatures. There would have to be a challenge to those signatures. The hearing officer would have to find that Mr. Krizloff did not collect enough signatures, and the electoral board would have to agree with the hearing officer, thus preventing Mr. Krizloff's name from appearing on the ballot. And such speculation is insufficient to show that appellants have for the requisite personal stake in the outcome of this litigation. Additionally, for the reasons set forth in our response, we believe that the Rooker-Feldman doctrine applies both in the macro level with respect to the Jackson-Hicks case and in the micro level.
I've never heard of Rooker-Feldman applying in that way. Jackson-Hicks was ages ago, and usually it's a case that involves, you know, the state court loser who is now trying to come in and get a judgment undone. The notion that Rooker-Feldman extends all the way to efforts to cast doubt on the soundness of some earlier state court decision strikes me as pretty extreme.
No, and even if that's so, Judge Wood, the electoral board decision itself is a final order under Illinois law, so Rooker-Feldman would still apply to the electoral board.
That would be an administrative application of Rooker-Feldman. They're not a court.
That's correct. But but that has been found to be under Illinois law a final order. Until
haven't we said that Rooker-Feldman doesn't apply to administrative proceedings?
No.
Regardless of how Illinois law might characterize something coming from an administrative board?
No, that very well may be true, Your Honor. If that is true, then I would withdraw that argument.
Indeed.
And then the final issue, just to raise it briefly, is that it is undisputed that the appellants didn't properly serve the electoral board or the intervener objectors as required under Illinois law. And these are additional grounds for dismissing the state court claims. And if the court has no further questions for me, for the reasons that I've discussed and for the reasons set forth in the response, we would respectfully ask that this court affirm the district court. And I'll cede the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Krisloff?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. In our reply at page 2, footnote 1, we cite the Poole versus City of Houston case reversing dismissal and remanding for the circulators' concern about signature requirements in future elections, and the Reclaim Idaho North Ninth Circuit case remanding for the opportunity to develop a record below on the likely recurrence of an in-person signature controversy. The fact is that Judge Kendall found that there was likely a due process, having commented that there was likely a due process.
She didn't say that. All she said in the footnote was, if there's any, what you're talking about sounds more like due process to me. But then she said, but I don't have to worry about it because you didn't pursue that theory. Obviously, you don't have to plead legal theories anyway in federal court.
But right.
What she says is Krisloff might have some sort of due process claim, but he does not allege a due process claim, and the court has received no briefing on whether the facts alleged state such a claim. That's a far cry from saying that you have a due process claim.
Not that we have it, but she clearly thinks that there might be one. And given that, the Runyon case, which is this court's basic direction to the courts below, on the first dismissal, you should give the leave to amend, that we should have been given the opportunity to develop that one. The question of whether close enough in an election where it is between the candidates as to which one has more, that's one whether it's close enough between the two of them. And in those elections, in those situations, as we've seen every 4 years and some of the 2 years in between, every possible opportunity to show statistically and forensically that the signatures are valid is given. Whereas here, the whole purpose is to show, does the candidate, and for Mr. Powers, who single-handedly obtained more than 1,000 signatures himself because he believed in this campaign, to know for the future. The issue is, has the candidate shown a sufficient modicum of interest? And whether it's a 1%, 0.4%, whatever percent, the issue is, has the candidate shown a sufficient modicum of public voter interest in the campaign? And to say that we're going to let lay people without any expertise in this make that determination without affording the requested opportunity to show statistically. But if you're talking about even professionals, we had met the margin. That's what makes this a First Amendment case. That's what's going to happen every time, and it's going to happen every time without the ability of people to defend their candidate or to have their issues presented. We've seen Krizlov against Rednauer was cited yesterday by the District of Maine. These petition cases.
Thank you, Mr. Krizlov.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.